Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ole, ole. C'est la Peña Bayona, on est tous là, allez les gars, encore une fois.
I've got a situation for you.
Okay.
You ready?
I love situations.
You love situations. We're often saying that of you. You are the situation meister.
That is right? My second nickname after Rugby League Squidge.
Yeah. You are Andy Gomesol. Okay?
Am I?
For the sake of this situation, you are Andy Gomesol.
Okay, hang on. Let me just get the character. Sonny Bill!
Sonny Bill Williams.
Sonny Bill Williams, what
man.
A great player. He really just works.
You
and
are.
I bet you all the money in the world that he is a good offloader.
You are Andy Gomesol, right?
I am Andy Gomesol.
You are also Alex Mitchell. You are also Richard Wigglesworth.
Okay, yeah.
You are also Richard Hill, the scrum half, not the flanker.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know what you're saying.
You are a decidedly pretty average, slightly above average, like a 6 out of 10 international player who finds themselves in, inexplicably, the starting jersey for a massive World Cup knockout game. What do you do?
I carry on talking about Sonny Bill Williams and spending all the money in the world and then regaining it because I somehow still have all the money in the world. And I carry on looking like a man made of plasticine.
I mean, that's a very good start. It's a very good start. Being the most despicable man in the world, Richard Hill, who is just everything everyone hates about English rugby, rolled into one estate agent. But you find yourself in this one knockout game, right? Do you inexplicably become a good game controlling scrum half?
You raise a valid point.
Because, look, the game today, welcome to the World Cup retrospective, whatever, is Australia's quarterfinal, what they expect to be Australia's astounding win over England in the quarterfinals. England won 12 points to 10. And the thing this put me really in mind of was, I think Andy Gomesol, right, who's been pretty ropey this entire tournament, and is remembered as a perfectly okay player.
Yeah.
I thought he had a fantastic game.
Oh, God, I feel so uncomfortable agreeing with you.
Yeah. The thing is, I then thought about the knockouts in the World Cup this year, right? And Alex Mitchell, I think, is a brilliant Premiership player, and I think he always looked a bit dodgy in a test shirt.
Agreed.
Then the World Cup knockouts came around, and suddenly he was excellent.
He looked great.
Suddenly he was
knockouts.
Fantastic.
Like that game against South Africa, the biggest game of his life, was the best game I've ever seen him play by like a long, long stretch. And I've seen him play well since then. Like in this first couple of rounds of the Six Nations, he's been good. Weirdly, in the European Cup for Northampton, he's been playing really well.
Yeah, against Munster is fantastic.
Yeah, it's not just like mid-table Premiership games he's dominating anymore.
Yeah.
Like, suddenly he's looking like an actual like competent scrum half who isn't just a fast lad who can whip a ball away. You know,
he was
always
the vibe I got
good.
Off him. Yeah.
Yeah.
You put him up against Worcester or Newcastle and he's a world beater.
Yeah.
You put him against Scotland or Ireland and suddenly he's passable.
Yeah.
He's not a player that raises his game with the standard, with the level, you know. Andy Gomesol, likewise, was all right. But then there's this trend I've started to realise, right? And there's another trend we'll get onto with England and World Cups. But England scrum halves always seem to come good in World Cup knockouts, like it's what they're born to do. I'm just
especially
fascinated
the plasticine
by this.
Looking ones.
Especially if they look like Aardman characters.
Yeah.
Funny enough, none of those players played for Bristol, the home of Aardman.
That's true.
But hey, and you know, you walk around Bristol and like it's just full of like Wallace and Gromits everywhere. For anyone who's never been to Bristol, like they just have like benches which are like grommets on them, and they have like these massive grommets up all over. As in not like the ear thing, like the dog.
But you know who I'm glad I've not seen around Bristol before?
Who are you glad you've not seen around Bristol before?
Andy Gomesol, no.
Yeah.
Feathers McGraw. That
Indeed.
Shit cunt.
So, we're here to talk about England's win over Australia at the Stade Velodrome in Marseille, which looks very different to how it is now.
Yeah, it seems like they've extended it massively since then.
Yeah, and built a roof.
There's another couple of tiers. Yeah, and a roof.
Glorious stadium, though. Like, it looks fantastic. And then you go and visit it for the quarterfinals last year, and it's the biggest shithole you've ever been to in your life, Marseille. I hate that town more than anywhere I've ever been in the world.
It was a lovely stadium. Lovely stadium.
They have put one of the best stadiums in the world in one of the worst places on earth, and I admire their cahoots.
And when you look at like the overhead camera, right, on Marseille around the stadium, that surrounding area is beautiful. But the rest of Marseille is the shittest place. It's French Birmingham, but times a thousand. It's dreadful.
You find odd people who really loved it there, and you can tell they are properly posh wankers who were spending endless amounts of money to stay in one of the three nice hotels, because there's a few like nice hotel complexes around the stadium. There's a bay that is itself nice, and you walk for literally 1 minute past it and it's a shithole again.
Yeah,
we saw the Rugby World Cup there, like we stood close to it. They had it in the shop. They had in the World Cup shop there,
and they
Marseille.
Had a helicopter flying over it just in case anyone nicked the World Cup.
Yeah, and like a guy standing there going, "It is the World Cup." He was French. What a weird time that was, that week in Marseille. That was one of the most weird, miserable.
The door on the apartment we're staying in didn't shut.
Yeah. Like, and there wasn't,
we thought we were going to get murdered.
Lock the front door. So we were like leaving every night when we went to bed, leaving chairs and everything propped against the door because it was the dodgiest area in the dodgiest town.
I was sleeping in the room that you would walk in through, a very faltering door. I was completely certain that we were going to get murdered. When we walked around the corner to go to the shop, like constantly, I was like, I'm getting stabbed here.
Well, like the first day when we went to go to the shop, right, we have to walk through this little like square area. And there was just like a kid with a bow and arrow firing at the walls.
Oh my God, yeah.
There was a fire pit with like children chanting around it. It was horrible. There's just broken glass all over. You get
and
the
people
shop and
playing like very loud
up.
French trap music around, like all around the place.
It's like uniquely horrible. There were literally people with like vodka pouring it on the fire to see if it got close to burning a child's face. I'm not even exaggerating. It's the worst place I've ever been in my life.
I remember on the last day there, because like, we spent that whole time just lamenting it and just like hating every single second of it. But I remember on the last day, you said to me, like, would you ever come back to Marseille? Like, if Wales got into a World Cup final that's been played in Marseille or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I think if Wales played in the World Cup final in Marseille, or if Bruce Springsteen came and played here, I would come back. And then Bruce Springsteen announced his tour and Marseille was on there. I was like, fuck that. I'm not going there.
No way.
So I think I've just manifested Wales making a World Cup final that's going to be held in Marseille.
Again, I've had the same thought about, like, if the Ospreys reached a final in Marseille or something. I think it would have to be, like, I wouldn't go for the Challenge Cup final. Champions Cup final, I think about it.
Sure.
I think about if I can get in and out in a day. I don't need to stay overnight.
24-hour round trip.
Yeah. I spoke to someone else after I got home who'd stayed in Marseille, and, like, they had to sleep on a bench because the keys weren't in the lockbox when they arrived at their Airbnb.
Jesus.
And like everyone I know who went to Marseille had a horror story there. Apart from, as I say, the odd person who had thought it was the loveliest place they ever went. God, I hated Marseille more than I can possibly express.
So we'll set the scene for where this is being played, right?
Yes.
But one thing I need to quickly establish, right? So you've established that I am part-time Andy Gomesol.
Yes.
And I want to just quickly double check.
Alex Mitchell.
Yeah. I'm a scrum half who lives in England. That's all you need to
know
about
true.
Me. Yeah. I want to just double check, who might you be?
Oh, I'm Robbie or Squidge, whatever you want to call me.
Excellent.
Are we all well?
Yeah. I mean, good. Other than memories of Marseille, which
are
very traumatic.
Get rid of them. Just chuck them out your head. I want to, like, Eternal Sunshine my memories of Marseille out my brain. Just want to just get rid of them. But, like, I won't keep running into Marseille on a train and falling in love with it. Thankfully, I'll just get out of Marseille on a train. One of the best moments of my life when I got to get on the train out of that bloody city. The fly out of there.
I flew away from there.
Yeah.
It
glorious.
Was great.
No, I got like a 7-hour train to Claremont. I was just glad to be out there. Claremont's lovely. I liked Claremont.
Yeah, I bet. But I flew back home to... No, I actually had to fly to London, which still isn't great.
It's
but
fine.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, the first quarterfinal between Australia and England. a game that I think is reasonably fondly remembered in England as a kind of one of the few times England was a real underdog in a World Cup and it all came good. In Australia, it's remembered as a game to forget.
Yeah. This is simultaneously, like, this is one of the most cagey games I've ever seen. It's two teams who are so reluctant to screw up, so reluctant to play into each other's hands. And yet, I really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it.
I thought it was really great that it was like a parody of a nervy game, you know?
Yeah.
You turn it up to 100, all 30 players want this so much. And you can, there's a lot of errors, sure. But again, like, most of them are forced by each other or just by the sheer occasion. And again, the atmosphere in the stadium's great. Both sets of fans are, again, very nervous. It's the biggest game of any of these players' lives other than the ones who played in the World Cup final 4 years ago, which was this same fixture. So that was a big part of the narrative going into it.
Yeah. Yeah. Repeated the final from 4 years ago, which had been an upset at the time. Australia would, you know, expect to win that. They're at home.
Yeah, at home. Yeah.
And then England turned up and they take them to extra time. And then Johnny Wilkinson kicks a drop goal in the dying moments of that game. One of the most iconic rugby moments of all time, probably up there with Jonah Lomu running over Mike Catt, who plays at 12 in this game. Paul Sackey, who's on the wing for England, said this was his favourite game he ever played in.
Okay.
The stadium, the atmosphere, our passion of fight, everybody thought we were going to lose that game, but everybody thought we were going to lose every game. We dominated the scrum in every aspect. We were physical, clinical, and we just wanted it more.
I mean, fair enough, but... It's, so as people who have watched back every game of this campaign, right, I want to kind of like set the scene of just how much, I guess, things were meant to be going in Australia's favour, right?
Yeah.
So I want to just quickly read out a review that was left on the podcast saying, could be a great pod if it wasn't for the constant childish hating on the England team. Bitter. That is from Dan Bronx, left in October 2023. And it made me think... Are we hating on the England team so much, or have they just been dog shit so far in this Rugby World Cup? And I think it's very much the latter, but also, they're excellent in this game.
Yeah, I think they look like a average team playing above themselves, but then they've been a much less than average team over this tournament.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to express just how poor they've been, both put against the standard of the other competition, of the other teams in this tournament, but also... When you put them against modern rugby, they're unbelievably atrocious.
Yeah.
Like, if you drop this England team into, like, modern rugby, you're looking at them, they wouldn't make the championship, you know?
Sure.
Like, they are kind of a semi-professional standard team.
Yeah.
At best.
Yeah. And again, that's no shade against them. That's just about how far rugby's come since then.
With a few exceptions. Like, you know, if this England team were a championship side, right, which they kind of are in quality, Johnny Wilkinson would be picked up immediately and keep climbing all the way up because he's exceptional. And he kind of keeps his team flooding. When they have your friend of mine, the man of the basement.
Yes, Ollie Barkley.
Ollie Barkley at 10. When he isn't bloody listening to Trap in his garage, they look atrocious.
Yeah.
When Barkley's at 10, they've been genuinely dog shit. And there's this thing where, like, I think a lot of people assume that, you know, there's a level of bias or whatever being Welsh fans. I don't feel any of that, at least anymore, because I've been doing, you know, I've been covering rugby as a job for 6 years now. And it's amazing what that does, what having to cover everything objectively does for, like, actually leveling you out and making you feel objective about things. Like,
I learned very early into watching rugby that if you're biased about something, if you're expressing an opinion that is biased, that doesn't actually change anyone's performance on the pitch, so it's pointless.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the thing of, like, yes, we've said this before, but, like, occasionally there's a bias, but, like, the bias is, I'll notice if Aaron Wainwright makes 26 ruck entries. I'm more likely to, because I'm paying more attention, I'm paying a closer attention to Wales and to the teams he plays for than I am to
others.
Yeah,
you appreciate your own team's players better. You just do, no matter what. It's the same in any sport. It's the same in any brand, any era in the world.
Because if you're watching a game as neutral, right, you're watching both teams equally. If you're watching your team play, you're only watching your team, whether on attack or defence, or primarily you're only watching your team, you know.
Yeah.
So they're getting like 70% of your attention, the other team's getting 30, even if what the other team's doing is more interesting.
But
so
for
it
instance,
lead to a
we
level
watched
of...
the 1987 Wales team and they were dreadful. They were so, so bad.
They were relative to everything in terms of teams that overperform. They were drastically worse than this England team.
Yes, absolutely agreed. And you compare that to the Australia team that they have. Again, before we get into the actual players playing and stuff, this Australia team were, I guess, world class in a really unserious way, if that makes sense. They were scoring 90 points against the teams that they were meant to be beating, whereas England were kind of scraping by against the likes of Tonga and the USA. Australia were battering Japan, battering Wales. They were really like cruising through the pool stages, but in a really attractive way. You know, it's much easier to look at a team playing like that and say that they're playing well than one that scrapes by. And that's just the nature of how we are conditioned as rugby fans to appreciate teams and how they're playing.
Yeah. It's the thing that's often led to teams like, you know, New Zealand, Ireland at the minute, France in the last few years, being higher rated than what we've seen in the past, England and Wales teams and South Africa teams, who win every game and win as many games as those other sides, but they win them by smaller margins because of their style of play, because their style of play is not more negative, because I hate that being something being positive or negative as whatever, but you know, they are perhaps a lower scoring team. It's just their style. It's the way they play. They grind teams
more
down.
More risk averse.
Yeah. They grind teams down rather than playing this endless attacking rugby. And people will say that the team that, you know, scores more tries is more important than the team that wins more games. And actually, I think there's something in this England team, right? Yes, they've been atrocious, but they've won all their games but one, where they were absolutely battered. But that's a whole other thing. Whereas this Australia team hasn't been in that habit. They haven't had to win a close game over this World Cup. If you look at the year coming into this, right, Australia in two games over the full year before this quarterfinal that finished by within 7 points or less.
Wow.
Well, you know, that was decided. One, they won against the All Blacks, 20 points to 15, and one, they lost against the Springboks, 22 points to 19.
Okay.
So one win, one loss from those situations, both of them higher scoring games than this. Both of them in that sort of 20s realm where they were scoring multiple tries and able to get in there. Otherwise, you look over the year coming into this, right? And it's like there's a 49 win over Fiji. There's a 31-0 win over Wales. There's a 44-15 win at Murrayfield. Like, they are consistently winning games. They had a draw with Wales like 18 months beforehand. But otherwise, like, all their games are either blowouts or significant losses against the All Blacks. But actually, no. They've got a few close games against the All Blacks in this time. Then they've got, like, a 32-12 loss the year before. But, like, they beat the Springboks 49-0 in 2006. Like, it's incredible the way this team, when they click, how good they are.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing which I think can be construed as both a good and a bad thing is at 10 they select Berrick Barnes, who is at this stage on maybe his fourth cap, I believe. Made his debut against Japan in the first game of the group stages, and at this stage he has not yet been challenged in Australia jersey. He has not yet played in a game that requires any sort of management. He's played extremely well. He's guided them to high score lines, which is a great thing. So I suppose maybe it's a good thing to put in a lad who's high on confidence and only knows how to win by margins. But on the other hand, when his opposite number is Johnny Wilkinson, who will grind you down, keep you on the floor, and force you to play a game of rugby, is that the guy you want in there? I don't know. And I'm not saying that Berrick Barnes played badly at all, because I don't think he did. But at the same time, you know, if you've got someone like Stephen Larkin to maybe bring off the bench for him, then maybe it's a different scenario. Instead, they leave on Julian Huxley as an unused substitute. Also, talking of unused substitutes in Rugby World Cup knockout games, Dan Hipkiss is an unused sub for England.
Well, today we should probably look at the team, shouldn't we?
Yes.
So, Australia. Let's look at Australia first, because you mentioned Berrick Barnes, which is the big headline, I think. The fact that he starts this game, which seemed like the safe bet at the time, but as you say, it's a gamble that perhaps wasn't appreciated the week of this game, because he was in such great form coming in. But Chris Latham continues in at fullback. It's a really strong team. Sterling Mortlock is
It's a really experienced back line is the thing. Yeah. You've got Mortlock and Gitto in the centres. You've got Gregan at nine, and it's easy to go, they've got an inexperienced 10. But is there a nine in the history of rugby who you'd rather have, like, hold his hand through this?
Yeah.
Probably not.
This was his 139th and final cap. The most capped player of all time at the time.
Yeah. And what a World Cup he was having, still.
Yeah. Unbelievable. And, you know, still stands as the most capped scrum half of all time, ahead of Ben Youngs in second place. Then, Berrick Barnes continues at 10. You've got Lottie Decurie and Adam Assey Cooper on the wings, who are both fantastic players and in great form. Drew Mitchell's left on the bench despite some really good form in the knockout in the group stages. Then the pack is perhaps the interesting one, right? Because England's pack is a bunch of niggly bastards.
Yeah.
And Australia's pack are ballers. Golden Coast ballers across the board.
To kind of cross the two over, England's pack, they clearly prioritise weight and power rather than, ball skills. For instance, on the Loosehead side, you've got Phil Vickery versus Matt Dunning. Extremely different styles of prop. Matt Dunning is technically a very good scrummager, but gives away a couple of pounds to Phil Vickery, who scrummaging and just brutality is his kind of niche, his thing.
Phil Vickery can kick a drop goal.
Yeah, exactly that. Especially not by accident. Again, like Simon Shaw and Ben Kay.
Though Matt Dunning couldn't win MasterChef. So
that's also true.
You've got talents all over.
Yeah, Simon Shaw and Ben Kay, both brutal locks, like great in the line out, will smash any breakdown, whatever. Nathan Sharp and Dan Vickerman are more sort of like rangy technical locks, you know, who will do something good for you in the loose. So yeah, extreme contrast in those two packs.
Yeah. And so the guy Shepherdson is a tight head, who is one of these players I've seen playing this tournament and completely forgot over the time we were off. Just no memory of him whatsoever. Kind of one of the surprise inclusions, had made the squad the year beforehand, basically played until this World Cup, had like 1 year in the Australia squad and managed to be first choice for a World Cup. Mad. Could have won a World Cup, you know, things have gone differently. Stephen Moore, speaking people at kick. Oh boy, do we get onto that.
Oh yeah.
Rocky Elsom, George Smith and Wycliffe Parlour is an incredible back row, but it's very, very different to the England back row, which is Nick Easter, Lewis Moody and Martin Corrie. All three of those players are bastards. All three of the England back row are pricks on the field who you hate to play against. All three of the Australian back row are players you love to watch.
That's it.
There's a big difference between those two.
If you showed me in isolation those two back rows and asked me which one I thought was better, I would definitely say the Australian one.
Every time, yeah.
But that's probably because Rocky Elsom scores loads of tries. Like, he's been criticised, as we've talked about in previous episodes of this, as being lazy, but he just pops up on the edge and scores tries. And you know what? He's bloody good at it, is the thing. Mm. George Smith is one of the best open sides to ever play the game. Eddie Jones obviously said he looks like he's covered in spiders because no one wants to tackle him. He's that guy, incredible at the breakdown. And, you know, Cliffy Parlour, great ball carrier, really good, just solid, what you want from a number eight, right? Does that job very well. As I say, maybe I'd say that that's a better back row, but is it the back row that played better in this game? I don't think it is. You've got
England
back row, as you say, of three pure bastards who carry the ball well, don't do anything fancy, just stick it up the jumper and move forward, which is all England needed to do in this game.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, the commentator brings up the remarkable stat. Nick Easter, 4 tries in his test career, all in the same game.
And we all know who that was against?
Yep.
Wales.
But Lewis Moody is in full-on niggly mode. You know that thing he did? Like, I guess younger listeners didn't watch Lewis Moody play. He was a really interesting player because he sort of doesn't exist anymore. There isn't like a Lewis Moody-type player anymore. The closest we've probably got is Justin Tipperick, who's still going. I'm sure there are more. But those players who just kind of like seem to slip into gaps in rucks and are just sort of there and like is really lightweight for an international seven, but has the energy is right. And it's not Martin Williams who's great at cheating. He just throws himself everywhere and he puts his body on the line constantly. And I don't know if there is an analogy at the minute for a player like Lewis Moody, who just like puts their body about everywhere.
Maybe like Fraser McWright. It's maybe the closest
maybe.
I can think of.
Fraser McWright's more of a ball player, though.
Yeah, he is. But I suppose everyone is nowadays.
Yeah.
It's all got to be relative. But Lewis Moody was a fantastic player. I think he played really well in this game. On sheer mentality, and I know that we discussed earlier in the podcast that this wasn't always a good thing, that it led to several concussion issues and injury issues later in his life. But he's brilliant when he plays for England. Like, there's something about whenever we watch games of this podcast, somebody who clearly loves playing for his country as much as he does is always something that's a joy to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. The England backline, though,
is
weird because it feels picked by a different guy to who picked the pack.
Yeah, it does.
So, no, I think 1 to 10, Because you've got Gomesol and Wilkinson as your halfbacks.
And this is Turbo Gomesol.
Great. Yeah, Turbo Gomesol, sorry. Yeah, Turbo Gomesol and Johnny Wilkinson as your halfbacks, right? Then the outside backs, beyond that, you've got Josh Lucy, Mike Catt, Matthew Tate, Paul Sackey, and Jason Robinson.
An injured Jason Robinson at that.
Team. Yeah, it's still electric.
Yeah, unbelievably good in this game. But yeah, he's injured. Like, they thought that he'd broken his leg or something like 3 weeks before. And he was just like, don't worry, I'm still better than... Who would have been the next choice, I guess, at this point? I can't really remember. Mark Cueto. Yeah.
They'd have found some bullshit to go and sit at the back. It would have been some guy that's played like 4 games for London Irish who they can call on. No, he's played like 168 games for Worcester and has been like a good servant who Brian Ashton will call on and go, it's your time, my son.
Yeah, so Jason Robinson goes in over 15-year-old Chris Pennell, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And again, these players didn't play badly or anything, but it's so weird looking at a World Cup quarterfinal team sheet that has Mike Catt, Matthew Tate and Paul Sackey as a consecutive trio on there. It's very strange to look at, but again, I suppose we'll get into how all three of those guys played.
Yeah, because we should probably move in the general direction of the game itself. So obviously the thing that looms over this was the World Cup final from 4 years previous. One of the most iconic and most famous rugby matches of all time. Maybe in terms of rugby as a kind of pop culture moment, might be the pinnacle of it in the UK.
Yeah.
In British rugby circles, it is the most talked about, most remembered game of all time.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, certainly sort of 30 and up, if you ask them about a rugby match, that's the first one that comes to mind.
They'll say Johnny Wilkinson's drop goal.
Yeah, that's the first memory that comes to mind for most people. There was a moment last year where, oh God, what's her name? The awful bloody Nadine Dorries. The awful woman, as I just trailed her. Nadine Dorries, who is a cabinet minister in the UK, who's an idiot. But she was kind of Boris Johnson's like best mate, but Boris hated her because everyone did. Whole thing. Anyway, she was doing the launch for the Rugby League World Cup coming back to the UK. And she was asked for her favourite rugby league moment. And she said Johnny Wilkinson's drop goal in 2003 was the best rugby league moment of all time. And no one corrected her. They just stared at her in Wigan.
Do you know what my favourite rugby league moment of all time was?
What?
Mick Morgan's commentary.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Yeah.
She should have said that. Pike. Yeah, it's just a much, much easier reference.
Simon
and everyone's going to get that.
Like when he says Middleton in field, he's talking about Simon Middleton.
How mad is that? And the fact that I'd watched that clip for like 10 years and I've been watching the Red Roses play for like 5 years before I realised that's the same guy.
The
incredible
same
crossover.
Guy.
Incredible.
So, yeah, that World Cup final looms big in the background here. Since that World Cup final, these teams had played 5 times and the results have been pretty unanimous. Australia won 4 of them. But the interesting thing is when you look at those results themselves, right? So the first game after the World Cup final, the year after, England came and played in Australia, and Australia won 51-15.
Wow.
Later that year, Australia came and played at Twickenham and won 21-19. The following year, England won by 10 at Twickenham, 26-16. But then, 2006, England went and toured Australia, and they got battered. 34-3 and 43-12. So there were 4 wins for Australia, 3 of them absolute smashings in the lead up to this, which very much, I think, fueled the confidence. You know, the fact the year before, these games have been 30-odd points. And now, the only one I remember from this era was the one game England won. You know, Australia went on and won the 3 games following this as well. Like, England wouldn't win again against Australia until 2010 with that Ben Youngs try and that second test. You know, start of Ben Youngs' career, his first start for England. He scores this brilliant solo try and kind of books himself a place in that 9 jersey for 50 more years until Alex Mitchell springs to life out of the Nardman cartoon. But yeah, the one game they remember is the one that people remember. 2007 quarterfinal.
They win the one that matters.
Yeah.
In terms of just before the game starts, the big moment of high drama that I really like is when the two teams come out.
Mm.
And so Phil Vickery is leading out England, Stirling Mortlock leading out Australia. And at this point, the two teams have to come out together is the vibe of this World Cup, rather than one team comes out first, then the other one. Because there's no home team, they both come out together, right? So Vickery and Mortlock slightly face off in the tunnel next to each other. Vickery kind of gives Mortlock a look, as if to say, you're going down again, kind of thing. And Mortlock has this kind of brash confidence about him. And so they're both given the signal, You can go on. You can run onto the pitch. Mm. And so run on, Australia do. Mortlock jogs out, looking very confident, as I say. And Vickery, on the other hand, walks very, very slowly with the intention of letting Australia get onto the pitch and stand there and think as they watch England gradually get onto the pitch. I really like this as a piece of mind games.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know entirely what it means, but I love that it happens.
The same part, I've got no idea what this means, but I kind of love it. I love it as a moment of drama, just as the two teams kind of having their own approach. And the, you know, the commentary says like, oh, they've each got their own style of how they want to run out. But it feels like England are doing it to put pressure on Australia somehow.
They are, yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like they're there to piss them off.
Because
they'll come out in their own time, at their own speed.
Yeah.
They'll play this game on their terms.
Immediately afterwards, the anthem starts for Australia, who are first on the anthems. And as they're starting, they're asked to move down and like file in differently. So like as the intro to Advance Australia Fair is playing, they all have to like shuffle down and get re-in a line further down. So that changes everything again. Like, it's a really disruptive first minute for Australia, I think. And I don't think it gets in their head. I think it's bullshit. No. I think, like, you know the infamous one about Ireland and the bus and everything?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I can get why that would frustrate a team. I don't think enough to lose a game, but I can see why it would get under their skin a bit. And, you know, and maybe once they've made a few mistakes on the field, they're thinking like, oh God, nothing's going our way this day. But I don't think these have any bearing on the result whatsoever.
Me neither, but it's fun narrative.
It's fun to add to it. My other favourite thing from pre-match, right, is Brian Ashton, when he's interviewed pre-match, says, I'm really glad we're going this game on an upwards curve, not a downwards curve. I'm like, yeah, dude. Yeah.
And he does add, no, it would be difficult, mate, to go on a downwards curve after losing to South Africa 36-0.
Yeah. Well, you know, but it got better. We beat Tonga.
Yeah, just. Yeah. Very interesting mixed vibes from England going into this, but
yeah,
quietly confident is the vibe.
Yeah. Toby Flood sings the English anthem in a World Cup quarterfinal, which is fantastic work. And then the game gets underway and it is immediately scrappy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, the first note I have is, wait, are they playing one at rugby on halfway in a Rugby World Cup quarterfinal? Specifically, I think talking about England here?
Yeah.
That they're on halfway, just going like one up forward crashes. And I'm thinking like, why are they not kicking it? Because at this current stage, if you are not going forwards and you are just constantly chilling around halfway for about 10, 15 phases, you just stick it in the air or you stick it downfield. You try and find some space. You try something different. But instead here, they go, oh, okay, that's not working. Let's just go to the backs instead. It's like, if anything, that's more risky.
So Joe Worsley was asked about this before the 2023 World Cup. He was asked about his memories of 2007 and England's run there and, you know, being in France and everything. And of this game in particular, he said that he felt like it was the game they needed. The two games before that, Tonga and Samoa, he said, were pretty bruising. We didn't play great, but we controlled them. We chiseled down how we were going to play over those two games. Which is interesting, because England, and it shows, didn't have a clear game plan going into the tournament, and they worked it out over those games against Tonga and Samoa. Which we've seen in other World Cups, where teams have got better as the tournament's gone on, and they've kind of refined their tactics.
Or held stuff back.
Yeah. But it feels insane that they went in without knowing how they're going to play, and they worked it out. And then they came into this game, and again, Simon Shaw was asked about this, and he said basically they looked at the Australian pack and they looked at the games they played against Australia before, where everything had gone well for Australia, except England got to the top of the scrum. And so they went, Well, that's what we've got to do. We just got to make the game as physical and as niggly as possible. Yeah, Simon Shaw said the mantra was, let's get the job done. It doesn't matter what it looks like. He said, no one's going to say they won a World Cup, but God, they played awful rugby. Who cares?
Which is funny because people are trying to say that about the Springboks these days, and it's not a valid argument.
No, exactly. And people said about England in 2023, and people said about England in this World Cup. And you know what? In many ways, they were right in this World Cup in particular. But I think it raises an interesting point, right? Because I think England in Rugby World Cups are split really cleanly into two categories with two outliers. So you have one category, the main category, which is World Cups, in which England were playing kind of sexy rugby, attacking rugby going into the tournament. And then they binned it all in order to play conservative rugby and they overperformed expectations, right? So you have last year, where Eddie Jones is trying to create this like really innovative new attack. They bin it, they get Steve Borthwick in, and they overperform expectations and finish third. You have 2007, where they do exactly that mid-tournament. 1991, they did that exactly mid-tournament, and then, you know, they get to the final and they start playing attacking rugby, infamously, and it all backfires on them. You have 2003, where they were playing far more attacking rugby with Brian Ashton as attack coach. He goes, they decide to lean fully into the Wilkinson drop goal bullshit, and they win a World Cup. The one real outlier is 2019, where they were excellent playing an all-court brand of rugby, which in some ways is the best like all-court rugby England have ever played. But they didn't have that one strength, which is maybe what they were missing in the way the Springboks did. They were kind of a, you know, masters of none and jack-of-all-trades kind of team. But the other category of England World Cup performances is ones where they continued trying to be the team who ran the ball and were exciting and people enjoyed watching them, and they underperformed and they went badly. So 2011, they did not lean into the Johnny Wilkinson bullshit as they tried. They picked Johnny Wilkinson and had him trying to play a game plan built more for Toby Flood.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work. Nothing worked.
And out of form Johnny Wilkinson as well.
Yeah. 99, likewise, like nothing really clicked. They were trying to continue with the kind of attacking rugby form they'd been in the Carling era and couldn't do it. And then, most famously, 2015, yeah, where Stuart Lancaster had built this side that was lovable and friendly and everyone enjoyed watching them. And he wanted England to be a team that people didn't hate anymore. And they did that. He got them to be that. And they were shit.
Yeah, they went out in the group stage.
Knocked down the group stage in their home World Cup. Only team to ever be knocked down the group stage of the home World Cup. And the only England team to ever go out in the groups.
Yeah.
Right. So a colossal failure, really, all around. That is to say, basically, at World Cups, right, England have a choice, play boring rugby or underachieve. And I know it doesn't always have to be like that, and 2019 proves that. But at the same time, it kind of feels like it's in the English rugby DNA. And you can see there's a stage in this game where England keep making it so scrappy that their chances start to rise. Yeah. And the thing I have in my notes from pretty early on, from sort of maybe 10 minutes in rather than the very start, but if Johnny Wilkinson goes full Fidim and just takes control of this game, England are going to win without question.
Yeah.
If he does a Dan Bigger and goes, this game is mine now, I am grabbing the scruff of its neck and I shall never let thee go, England are home and host.
On the basis that a lot of people say this is the worst team to ever make a Rugby World Cup final. A lot of people made that observation. And on the base of the group stage, I obviously agree, looking and going like, how do these guys make the final? I looked at this game and thought, I'm willing to be convinced, because the style of rugby that they play, it is just winning rugby. It's what you want to play. They clearly know what the formula is for winning a World Cup knockout game.
Yeah,
I think Mike Catt is weirdly brilliant in this game.
Okay.
Early on, he puts a lovely chip, which very nearly leads to a try, if not for quite an unlucky bounce. He often, when Gomasol is under a bit of pressure, he steps in and delivers passes from nine, box kicks even. There's one box kick he puts in, which would be a 50-22 nowadays, early on. And he's a really good foil for Johnny Wilkinson in this game. And I'd spent all of this tournament going like, what does Mike Catt really bring, though? And I watched this game and went, oh no, he's a bit of an all-round centre. And he had a really good game.
Well, because the interesting thing about that England team, right, is you compare it to the team that got battered in Australia a year beforehand by Australia, and there's only three players in the starting team that remain to the team that plays in the quarterfinal, who are the two centres, Mike Catt and Matthew Tate, and Lewis Moody, a seven.
Okay, interesting.
Mate, that England team is dog shit. Oh, no. It's mad. Peter Richards and Ollie Barkley as halfbacks. Pat Sanderson, Aiton captain.
Oh, wow.
Ian Bolshaw, Tom Von Dell and Tom Voice on the wings.
Oh, Tom Voice, good player.
Good player. Magnus Lund at six.
Oh, like, yes.
It's you've got Andy Goode and Jamie Noone on the bench with Nick Walsh as a scrum half. I don't know who Nick Walsh
Never
was.
Never heard of him.
He went to an independent school in West Sussex.
What a surprise.
He went on to coach England in the 20s in 2013. Yeah, won two caps for England on that tour. Played 96 games for Bath and a bunch for Sale and Saracens as well.
He's would have been unreal if he made it to a quarter final, though, wouldn't he?
Yeah. Currently attack coach at Coventry in the Championship.
Oh, good for him. Good for him.
But, like, the Australia team is pretty similar. The Australia team is almost the same. There's a few changes, like, you know, Gitto comes in for Matt Rogers at 12. But otherwise, you're looking at pretty much the same side, and Stephen Moore comes in at hooker. But the England team is completely different. And what they've done is they've reverted back to 2003, and they've reverted back in more ways than one. They've brought back in a lot of older heads and nigglier players, and they've also brought in a lot of Leicester Tigers players, which I think is notable, because it's an era where Leicester Tigers were completely dominant, and they played a completely forward-based style of rugby. There was no expansive rugby being played there at all. They won the Premiership over and over again by having the best pack in the Premiership, and you kind of had Wasps under Warren Gatland were kind of the other contenders there, and they've got a few Wasp players in there, like Simon Shaw and so on, and Andrew Sheridan and Phil Vickery, but they've got a very, very big, like, Leicester contingent, especially in that back five. And then on the bench, they've got more. And I think a lot of that, just DNA of getting in two really solid packs, taking them in and bringing back the 2003 mentality as well as the literal players, has helped them enormously. Because suddenly they feel like a different team.
But you know what I realise now we're addressing all of this as the post-game narrative, I suppose.
Yeah.
In the first 20 minutes, Australia really get on top in the scrum?
Yeah.
And only for the first 20 minutes. And I kind of didn't realise what a big, massive momentum shift that is, because one of the first things that happens in this game, Australia win a scrum penalty and Mortlock goes for it from about 40 metres and misses. At which point, Wilkinson puts in the 22 dropout, England give away a penalty at the breakdown straight away, and Mortlock goes for it again and gets it from pretty much the exact same spot. Which, you know what, fair play to him, second time does it. But after that, Australia do get a couple of scrum penalties, and Mortlock leaves sort of 6 or 9 points out there that come from the scrum being a good platform, and they don't capitalise on that, unfortunately. And then, unfortunately, that swings for them. It goes in England's favour.
That penalty, so he misses a penalty really early on. He then kicks one a few minutes later, like makes amends immediately. That is the only one of his five shots at goal that he gets. Well, he gets the conversion as well for the try later, but it's the only one of his five penalties he gets, which is huge in this game, particularly when the opposite man is Johnny Wilkinson and his presence looms large. So when asked about the England team, John Connolly, the Australia coach, says they've got a few really obvious strengths. They've got a good pack. They've got a great scrum. They've got Wilkinson and they've got some pace out wide. Right? There are very few other players that we talked about that blatantly.
Name
drop. Yeah. They wouldn't go, oh, they've got so-and-so who's a good player, so-and-so. They just say Wilkinson offhand because everyone knows what that means.
But when you watch this game, you have the exact same thought, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. Like, they've got Johnny Wilkinson.
There's a point early on, well, not early on, it's not long after that penalty, right, where England have a really nice attack where they go wide and it's off turnover ball, so Simon Shaw gets the turnover sort of on the 10-metre line in the Australian half. They go wide, doesn't really work, and then try going wide again. And there's this lovely back inside ball from Martin Corrie to Jason Robinson. And Jason Robinson makes a clean line break, which you can already tell in quite a cagey game is going to be a rarity. Robinson gets tackled and England go through 12 phases. And immediately, as a viewer, I'm going, come on, Wilkinson, I know you want this.
Yeah.
I know you want this. I know you want to just cash in and take 3 points out of this. And unfortunately, they don't. Mike Catt makes a little half break, forces an offload off the ball, and they lose it on the 5 metre line.
They lose it on the 5 metre line, and it is thrown loose to Stephen Moore, who goes, shit, got to get rid of this. And does, genuinely, I think the worst clearance kick I've ever seen in my life. He kicks it straight up in the air and like 2 meters across, straight into the hands of Lewis Moody.
Yeah, literally on his own try line.
Yeah.
And at that moment, you remember this is a World Cup quarter final and you go, oh shit, that's not good. That is not what they wanted here.
It's atrocious. Like Dick of the Day nomination worthy.
Yeah.
England keep playing and eventually they do give away the penalty, which they kick to put them back 6-3 up.
Yeah, Mike Catt does two grubbers in that movement, which both work, which is quite fun.
He's a cat, isn't he? He loves to chase a ball.
Yeah, fair point.
But yeah, this is the thing. This is the moment I start to think, like, the moment Wilkinson steps up and takes control of this, this game is going to be won. Yeah. Really interesting as well, and this comes up again later in the game, but how differently I feel watching continued possession and phase play in that era to the current era.
Mm.
And, you know, there was a thing, you go back maybe 5 years to 2018, 2019, and the more phases you went through, the more likely you were to score at the time, right? Now, the more phases you go through, the less likely you are to score.
The less likely most teams score.
Yeah, exactly. Most teams score, like, I think something like 80% of tries are scored in the first three phases.
Yeah.
First five, like, once you get past five or six, your chances go down dramatically because defenders get on top and they swarm you and you start to lose shape. That didn't feel the case at all here. And it felt just like genuinely like recycling the ball and like you had another go. Mm. It didn't feel like there was one team getting on top of the other. It didn't feel like going through, you know, could England go through, if you include both sides of that Stephen Moore clearance, England go through probably about 20 odd phases here. And it didn't feel like they were getting any more or any less likely to score with each one.
I know what you mean.
Where you look at, there was a really clear period 5 years ago where the team that had the ball more were more likely to score, where the team that has the ball less is, you know, the defence now is more on top if the team has the ball for long phases. We saw that with Wales big time at Twickenham the other week.
Yeah, massively. And once again, that really suits England because they have Johnny Wilkinson. I know that in this game, he isn't necessarily going for drop goals all the time. There's a few times where he does attempt it and misses, but
He just needs to stop pretending that playing for England in the 2007 Rugby World Cup is a team game.
Yeah, yeah. 100% that. He gets another penalty not long after this from 40-odd metres, putting England in the lead.
England start doing pick and goes on the 40-metre line, right? And it's the moment where you go, like, this is brilliant. This is exactly the tactic. Pick and go on the 40-metre line, take ages at every ruck, because they really were, because there was no, like, use it call from the referee at the time. He couldn't ping them for time wasting if they took as long as they wanted at every ruck, right? And what they would do is England forwards just kept picking fights at rucks. So, like, Lewis Moody and Martin Corrie at successive rucks pick a fight for a random Australian forward, and in one of them, one of them gives away a penalty, which Johnny Wilkinson then kicks from 40. And that is a brilliant game plan if you're in 2007.
I feel like my vision of Martin Corrie isn't the same as somebody who actually watched this era of rugby and supported England, right? But I feel like most of his job is to pick fights, and he's very good at it.
He takes lineouts and picks fights. Yeah. What more do you want?
Exactly. Good on him. Also, I'm kind of realising what probably happened regarding the scrum. I can only assume that Australia won those penalties illegally, had something pointed out to the referee, and then suddenly started getting pinged at every single scrum. I can only assume that's what happened, because Alan Rowland very quickly loses patience with them.
I think it's the sign of a great technical scrummager, though, if you can turn around a scrum that's struggling.
Yeah,
and Phil Vickery was a great technical scrummager. But also, nowadays as well, the sign of a great scrum coach, if they can turn it around and they can bring on a note or so. I remember Duncan Jones doing it once for the Ospreys, where they're really struggling against the scrum at Sale. And then Duncan Jones comes on during a water break and explains something to the props. You can see it on the camera. And suddenly they win penalties on the next couple of scrums.
Huh.
And that's the sign of a great scrum coach for me. And the sign of a great scrummager isn't necessarily just power. It's, can you turn around a scrum where you're struggling? And Phil Vickery very much does that. And that was Phil Vickery's real worth as a scrummager, rather than the pure power or the pure, you know, bloody big lumpness, if you're Adam Jones, you know, as he's described by Jason
Lennon. I guess his resilience.
Yeah. And he would find a way out of problems. He was a problem-solving prop, I guess, rather than
I really
a pure
like
power
him as a
prop.
Captain, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Props as captains has kind of gone slightly out of fashion in the last few years, and I don't like that.
Yeah.
Well, I know why it is. It's because they're obviously in odd condition to play longer than 50-odd minutes. And if you want a squad captain, you want them to probably be on for 70, 80 minutes. But I really like Phil Vickery as a captain. He seems really just genuinely positive and heartfelt in everything he does. And I get a real sense of honesty in the way he leads.
And he's a great England captain for the exact same reasons he was a really shit commentator on 2011.
Yes.
You know, because he absolutely loves playing for England. It means the world to him that he got to do that.
Yeah.
And then he won MasterChef as well. So what a blessed life he had.
Indeed.
But that is exactly the guy who wants to be a captain. A guy who makes you excited and thrilled and honoured to be playing alongside him.
Yeah. And I think that he kind of sums up what the role of a tight prop is. It's, I want you, 14, to do something more exciting than me so I can bend down and just win you the ball and do nothing else.
Yeah.
Like, how cool is that as a position in rugby? And if that's your job for your mates and your country, how cool is that?
Ashton's got plenty of leadership options in this team. You know, Dalio's on the bench, who obviously is captain England, will captain England again after this. Vickery's there, obviously. But then, like, Simon Shaw, Ben Kay, Lewis Moody, Nick Easter, Martin Corrie, and Johnny Wilkinson have all captained England before. Mike Catt as well. Yeah. All of them
Jason
have captained
Robinson's
England before.
Captain England.
Yeah, of course. So they're full of experience. And again, a lot of that is the team they brought in the last year. You know, Mark Regan as well, perhaps less of a captain, but like a really experienced player. Captain Bristol for a while as well. So you've got loads and loads of leadership options in that team, which becomes a vital part of it.
Yeah. And yeah, Vickery is the one. He is the one that makes the most sense. I love that he... I just love his approach to playing rugby, just generally.
We don't get many more chances to talk about Mark Regan, right? So I do want to mention something. So he played for England for the last time the following Six Nations in 2008. He then retired from international. He retired from rugby the year after for Bristol, but he plays the last season there. And England went, oh, fine, whatever, done. Big part of this, right? Big thing that came up was England beat France the following Six Nations in 2008 in Paris. And this was Mark Regan's last game for England. Marc Lievremont, the French coach at the time, said of Mark Regan, right? He said, I'm glad that grotesque clown is retiring.
how you show you've done a good job in an England shirt. You have left the jersey in a better position if that's what the opposition, particularly French coach, is saying about you afterwards.
His behaviour at times has always been unacceptable. He is a grotesque clown and I'm glad he's retiring.
That is a beautiful sentiment.
Mark Regan said, I'm disappointed he called me a clown, but when you come to France, you know you've got a good edge and get under blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah. Nah, he took that with pride.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
And forever now, that is how I will view Mark Regan and how Mark Regan should be viewed, as the beautiful, grotesque clown that Mark Lievremont hates.
Absolutely incredible. You're so far in his head. You're
so far in
his head.
Bring more of that back.
Yeah.
You know? Call Dan Cole a big shit.
Yeah,
Gaultier,
exactly.
I dare you.
Can somebody please interview Guillaume Garrido and ask his opinions on Sebastian Valmahina, please?
Yeah. Hurry up and do that.
So there's a point where I just have written my notes, Omg Peter Richards, because Andy Gomesall goes off for a blood substitution.
Yeah.
And they bring on the guy called Peter Richards, who apparently played for England. They bring him on in the quarterfinal, which is wild.
We get 6 minutes of heaven.
We do. 6 whole minutes of Peter Richards' quarterfinal. But England play a few phases. Cap was in a great hit of a kick chase. Saki wins a turnover. And they play a few phases, but not at any great particular speed. Which is...
No.
There's a moment that really just bugs me where Dan Vickerman gives away a really daft penalty for playing the nine.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, bro, chill. He's Peter Richards. You don't have to play the nine. You don't have to view him as any great sort of threat. Like, just let him be Peter Richards and your team will be okay.
It's what people mean when they say, let him be yourself.
Yeah. But Wilkinson misses the penalty anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah.
It doesn't materialise as anything, but, like, come on. It's Peter Richards. You don't
Peter
need to
Richards,
do that.
Formerly of Benetton Treviso.
Yeah, exactly.
Former Sevens player. He's like, normally when you see this, oh, a former Sevens specialist on the bench covering scrum half, you're like, oh, they'll be really nippy. No, he's Peter Richards.
Mind you, Alex Mitchell came from Sevens.
Yeah, and he's really nippy.
That's true. Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you were mixing up nippy and made a plasticine. Never mind.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. Yeah, easy mistake to make and knows what a reindeer is.
Knows what a reindeer is, eventually.
So, England start to slowly take control of this game, right?
Yeah.
And they are here a purely kicking team. And yet, my favourite thing that happens over this first half in particular is they have one vice. They're a team who kicks and fights and scrummages, but they have one thing they're addicted to, and that is quick dropouts.
Right. Where does the Nick Easter quick 22 dropout come from? How does that scan with this style of play? Is it just that everyone wants to do drop kicks now? Is that what it is?
England take 3 quick dropouts in this game.
Two of them by forwards?
Yeah. And the other by Paul Sackey. Like, it's a ridiculous
Ben
kind of wrinkle to their game. Yeah, it's Ben Kay, Nicky's report, Saki take their dropouts. And they're this team that they want to do nothing except slowly grind you down and beat you up and kind of get into you at scrum time and then watch Johnny Wilkinson kick it over from 40-odd meters and then nail a drop goal whenever they get into your 22, right? Except for unless it's a 22 dropout. And weirdly, I think Berrick Barnes starts to lean into this because they start kicking the ball dead a disproportionate amount of the time. And so then we end up keep watching England have to take these endless dropouts. And every single time Wilkinson's like lobbing it to someone quickly who's in a bit of space, who's taking this little quick dropout, and they'll try and play a bit of rugby. Then they'll go like, oh no, Johnny, can you do the kick you were going to do a minute ago? We hadn't farted around for a while.
But especially because you remember in the USA game, remember Ben Kay's kick that he attempted in there?
Yes.
And he thought, yeah, it's quarter final. I might as well do a harder version of a kick. I'll do a drop kick this time. That can't possibly go wrong. And it doesn't.
No.
But where does that logic come from? I guess he's been practicing the last couple of weeks just in case they needed him to kick.
It's a baffling, baffling addition to their game. But I greatly enjoyed seeing their one kind of vice and weakness.
They do, however, at one point run the move. You know the move.
The move. Yeah, the move. The move.
They run
we
the
love
move,
the move.
Where they chuck someone
in vogue at the time
and throw it back to Mark Regan, who runs into touch. It's a good move.
It's a good move. Good move. More on front rows running into touch later on.
Yes. Indeed.
So they get towards the end of this half, right? Adam Ashley Cooper commits a terrible tackle. He takes Paul Sakai out in the air completely. Horrible attempt to tackle.
He also drops a kickoff cold.
ASL. Yeah. There's kind of a rough few minutes. Yeah. England pump it long into the 22. And from there, finally, the moment the ball leaves the maul that England were trying to do for a bit, Wilkinson looks out wide. He's passing for a pass and he goes, nah, actually, and goes back onto his wrong foot and tries a snap drop goal attempt. And he misses it. But it's the moment I felt most convinced England were going to win this game.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you're going, oh, hold on. They're doing it. They're leaning into this approach.
Yeah.
They're really looking to lean
just
into
manufacture a shit drop goal out of
yeah.
somewhere.
Take 3 points
the same
everywhere.
Amount of points as any 3-pointer.
Yeah.
And he misses a penalty off the back of that as well. But the thing is, it doesn't really matter, even though it's more that they're getting these opportunities and you know that he will convert enough of them. You know that this isn't... That a Johnny Wilkinson off day is still worth more points than most fly halves.
Exactly, yeah.
But there's another big moment before half.
There is another big moment. We get a Scott Johnson jump scare. We see Scott Johnson out of nowhere, which is a cursed memory for Scotland or Ospreys fans.
Indeed. Indeed. However, there's a really nice break that Lottie Tincuri makes on his own, where he takes somebody on the outside. He has such good feet, Lottie Tincuri. He's such a fun player to watch. But he gets up into the English 22, and Australia slow it down for some reason. And it's really confusing that they're suddenly then just going, right, we'll go through the forwards, but we'll have really slow phases. And it gives England a lot of chance to kind of regain their breath, to defend, whatever. But luckily, this Australian backline are exciting enough that they have a couple more big moments in them.
I don't think they're slowing it down. I think England are doing a really good job of just chucking people in. Phil Vickery makes one particular really great job of slowing it down, where he's completely like over the ball, not supporting his own body weight, but Rowland lets it go for a while and then calls him to leave. Yeah, Alan Rowland, who's the referee in this game. Even if he wasn't, he could have just told him, you know. But the Australian commentators are furious throughout this game that Australia are leaving no one in the breakdown every time England have the ball. But England are throwing people in on every breakdown because they're just trying to get in amongst them and trying to slow it down. And I think there's a little bit of both. You know, I don't think Australia play to their full capability, but I also think this is the other passage where Australia have this ball for like 15, 16 phases, and you can never quite tell whether it's going well or badly.
Yeah.
Like they lose a lot of ground at one point, then they make it back up instantly with Gitto makes a half break, and, you know, there's a couple of lovely balls put in and a few good carries, and things start to kind of build slowly until it gets wide, and Berrick Barnes has two beautiful touches in a row.
He does. He does this fantastic dummy switch where he really sells it. He does the full let go with the ball and catch it again on that dummy switch, which is always very aesthetically pleasing when it works, and ships it onto Latham. Saki puts in a brilliant tackle on Latham to stop him just short of the try line. So they're up to within sort of 1 meter of the line now.
Yeah. At which point, everyone floods in. George Gregan is nowhere to be seen. Beric Barnes steps in at scrum half himself and makes a little dart before offloading to Lottie Dechoury, who's the one man alone on the side.
Yeah.
An England player goes in to try and tackle him. I'm not sure what, I think it might have been Tate. Goes in to try and get him. Dechoury kind of wriggles him off, future Leicester teammate, of course, very briefly, and dives over to score in the corner. Once again, against England, just as happened in that final in 2003.
It's a brilliant finish by Dechoury, isn't it?
It is.
With the outstretched right paw to slam the ball down there as he's getting tackled. It shows great strength to get over there. And yeah, it's a much better finish than it kind of looks.
Yeah. No, fantastic. And really well taken try by Australia and by Dechoury in particular.
Puts them ahead.
Yeah. The first 10-6. Moment where you feel like Australia are in the game and you feel like they could kick on from here. You know, it could kind of be England have an initial fight and then after half an hour, Australia wake up and kick on.
It's something that's so easy to underestimate in a knockout game, but just the same as if Wilkinson gets loads of penalty opportunities, eventually he's going to knock them over. If this Australian backline, as entertaining and flashy as they are, if they get space, that is worth potentially over twice as many points as that.
Yeah.
All it takes is for that to happen once. Even if they've had none of the momentum, they can suddenly shift the entire game. And if that happens again in the second half, they're winning. All they need is one more opportunity.
Exactly. And we sort of then spill forward into halftime.
Yeah. Ale plays in the stadium at halftime.
Which is fantastic. Great rendition. All the crowd are there with it. All the crowd are up for it. Scott Johnson's in the shed, so we're not looking at him. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. And then just as we all kind of settled into, well, are Australia coming back? Is this all going to happen? England win a scrum penalty straight off the restart, almost immediately. And kind of the inevitability begins.
Yeah. A great moment in that scrum as well is it leads to a fight. There's a great prop fight. Alan Rowland calls in the props. It's Andrew Sheridan and Matt Dunning have a little back and forth, bit of a fight. So he calls the two of them in as well as the two captains, including Vickery. And at one point, one of the Australian players, I think it's Dunning, says, "I didn't throw a punch, sir." And Alan Rowland goes, "I didn't say there was a punch," which shows that there definitely was a punch.
Very funny. Australia then have quite a long attack shortly afterwards, which looks like it's going somewhere, then it breaks down completely. They get turned up. Gitto gets, you know, sent backwards, gets kind of ball thrown behind him. He tries to recover. He makes a couple of yards. Then he just gets turned over and just flattened at the breakdown. Yeah. And Mike Catt picks up a scrum off and puts in a beautiful kick into the England 22, Australian 22, rather. He doesn't put it in his own 22, though I wouldn't put it past him, the way his England team has been playing. He puts it into the Australian 22. And again, it just feels like a big shift in momentum. It kind of feels like Australia aren't getting the breaks that it looked like they might be able to at the end of the half.
And they're not helping themselves, really.
No.
I think they're kind of inviting more and more errors. There's one point where England shove on Australia quite early in a scrum. And that's not to say that in a way it should be penalised, probably in a way that maybe should be reset. Mm. And yet, despite the fact it's Packer backpedalling, George Gregan puts the ball in.
Yeah.
And it just invites Australia to go backwards. And look, I don't want to tell the most capped scrum half of all time how to do his job, but I'd have thought that somebody with 139 caps in that position would know, you know what, let's just leave that one, see if we can get a free kick out of it, or just a reset, and then we'll go from there, rather than going, you know what, let's just put this ball in, and then he fumbles the ball at the back, Johnny Wilkinson picks it up. Luckily for Australia, Mike Catt drops it 5 metres out from the line, but England came so close to scoring an extremely cheap try there.
Yeah.
There's also a moment quite early on in that half where Nathan Sharp does like a head-on-head tackle on Mike Catt. And Mike Catt goes down, has like a bit of treatment to his head, checking he's all right. And one of the commentators said, "Oh, Mike Catt just needs to get up, take a glass of Harden up and get on with it." Shut up.
Jesus Christ.
Man. It shows how far
we've come a long way.
Yeah, I'd like to think that that was just a very of-the-time comment rather than a reflection on whichever commentator it is. But yeah. It's nice that those comments aren't made anymore.
A glass of Harden up.
Yep.
Wouldn't it be a solid food?
I think it would, yeah. It's a good
point.
Not
a liquid.
Yeah. By definition, yeah, you'd think so.
They're doing something wrong if you can drink it.
Yeah. Or you could have it just served in a glass.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can have ice in a glass and that's solid.
England do have one really clean cut opportunity to score in this half. Paul Sackey is right on the outside. They're going to score, but Unfortunately, the man in the wide channel is Mark Regan, who goes for the sidestep instead of the really simple pass to put the guy in space into the opportunity. It's like it's an Oppenheimer level bomb. Like, it's horrible to watch. Like, I thought it was Mike Catt at first, and I was like fuming at the thought of a 12, an experienced 12 who can play 10, bombing that. When you realize it's a hooker, it's slightly better, but you're still like, you should be able to pass a basic ball.
It's grotesque.
It is the work of a grotesque clown.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. But on that same one, England do come away with points, though, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They do. Wilkinson kicks a penalty shortly afterwards. Fascinating that every World Cup we've covered, England's primary goal kicker has been a man called Jonathan. Jonathan W. After Wilkinson and Webb.
Oh, good old Jonathan Webb.
Good old Jonathan Webb. He should be brought up in the conversation more as the best England player of all time.
Yeah, I think he really should. Although that said, we are forgetting about...
Yes, we are forgetting about him.
Yeah, Mike Harrison from Wakefield.
Completely forgetting about Mike Harrison at Wakefield.
Did you know that that's who I was going to say, or were you taking the piss?
No. No, you forgot.
Oh, and Peter Williams from Oral as well.
No, Mike Harrison of Wakefield is an excellent player.
Great
player. And I won't hear otherwise.
Yeah. Straight off the kickoff, Matt Kittu makes a break. Like, off a deflected ball, manages to put Wycliffe Palu through a gap, and they get through into the 22. And it's so annoying, because Australia just do not look after the ball, that Palu on the floor tries to slip it back and ends up getting the ball dislodged. And it's the cardinal sin at this point in the game. You're still ahead by 1 point, potentially luckily so. Just see if you can go through a few phases and see what happens. And it's infuriating that he tries this kind of like 10%er offload, which probably wouldn't lead to a try if he actually managed to get it to hand. It would maybe just speed up the ball a little bit. It's so infuriating that they don't look after the ball in that scenario.
Well, John Connolly, the Australia coach afterwards, said people will talk about the scrum, which got into strife, as he says it. But the real issue was England controlled the breakdown. And they are not looking after the ball at all. And I think a lot of that is a lack of focus rather than, you know, some inherent brilliance in the England play. I think Australia were not expecting this to be an issue because they've been playing off such quick ball all tournament.
Yeah.
And when we talk about kind of the stuff they haven't learnt from being in these blowouts all the time, right? Yes, a lot of it is the game management of Beric Barnes and so on. But a big part of that is just the forwards being able to deal with games in which they're not getting quick ball and being able to set up properly and generate quick ball again if you're not getting it and be able to reset and rework your entire game plan if things aren't going smoothly on the first few phases.
Spot on.
And instead, what's happened with Australia is they keep going through phase after phase after phase and it works out for the one try for Tecuri. It works out once in the entire game. They only score the one try. And they don't really have another passage where they are clean-cut going to score or they make it up there. There's a few individual breaks or individual moments where they get somewhere. I don't think there's a clean-cut chance again. Well, no, there's sort of one, but, you know, we'll get onto that. It's an issue. There is one real play that I love from Beric Barnes, though, where he takes the ball at 10 on one side of a ruck. The ball's on sort of the 50-meter line. And he throws the reverse pass, like, back to the winger on the other side who's in motion, which is a lovely, who's hitting an angle on the other side of the ruck. Loved it. Never seen that before.
No.
A move that I've never seen before that could be really effective. I want to see someone try that again now.
Yeah, I want to see if that still works.
Yeah.
With defences being as well drilled as they are, with the whole line coming up. See if you can catch someone napping with that kind of a
move. Because there was a phase a few years ago, about 3 years ago, of players running back towards the ruck because that was where the most space was because defenders pushed off in that very Springbok style of catch-up defenders would hair it across, assuming you're going outwards all the time, bring attackers back in towards the ruck in order to try and attack that space around the ruck again once they'd already left.
Yeah.
You could do something similar in hitting the other side of the ruck again. I just think that's an interesting kind of... It's an on-the-cuff play by Barnes who's just scanning the full field and notices something on the other side of the breakdown. But
it feels like something Italy would run these days.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like, oh, but this one defender is going to be out of place somehow. What elaborate play can we do to get the ball there?
You get the winger running what looks like a dummy line to hold the inside guard and instead, you know, have them actually hit that line. Yeah. I think that's interesting. I think there's something in that.
Agreed. Agreed. Australia lose the ball. Gomesol kicks it downfield and Chris Latham goes for an absolutely huge drop goal attempt.
Yeah.
I'll level with you. I really like this as an option.
Me too.
Because they're playing that poorly. that if they can just scrap some points that they don't deserve out of somewhere, that's exactly what they need.
Yeah.
Because they'll have another moment where they'll come back into the game. If they can get something out of this period, then that's a great shout. And it's very close to getting it.
They're one point behind.
It's a long-range one.
No, so they're one point ahead.
1 point ahead, yeah.
And he sends it just wide. He's got the distance.
Yeah.
He hits it from his own half. He's got the distance, and it goes wide.
Yeah.
And the commentators don't like this at all. They really hate it. But England take the 20 dropout, and this is the first one that they hit long properly, right? And Latham takes the ball in pretty much the same situation, right?
Yeah.
Only he carries it in, and they make it sort of 10 metres, right? So he's... What happened here was he gambled. Either I can take 10 metres, or I can have a drop goal attempt, then we'll get the ball back in the same place in like a couple of minutes' time.
Yeah.
And he took a shot.
Yeah.
No difference. I think it was a great option. And I'm surprised Australia didn't lean into it more. From that moment on, I was a bit like, well, why aren't they trying drop goals all the time? Because they know the dogfight they're in. They know they're against this England team who have
it
got
really
more points in them.
It frustrates me as well because the next attack they have... Because here Australia have like quite a few moments of possession around the England 22.
Yeah.
But aren't really doing anything creative with it, which is kind of the opposite of how they've been playing in the pool stages. Mm. There's one really infuriating moment where they get the ball back after... Ditto had pinged the 22. Saki had responded very well. And they gained loads of momentum kind of on the kick return. And at one stage, once again, Gregan's clearly off somewhere, probably with a Zimmer frame, you know, can't get to the breakdown. And they make like a half break on the edge. Beric Barnes comes in at 9, just as they're getting into the 22. It's completely isolated. So instead of like looking to fling the ball back in field, he just goes for a very short grubber along the touchline. And it feels like such a waste of possession. That they could have set for something, tried to go for the drop goal or milk the penalty or try and tie the England pack in some sort of way. And instead, he just completely wastes the ball. It's infuriating to watch. And again, I think that is an experience. That's the one moment where I looked at Barnes and went like, I'm not sure if you're cut out for this just yet.
But Australia's mindset is we're going to get the ball back soon anyway.
Yeah.
Their mindset is very much that of a sevens team or a touch team who are perhaps less focused on defending because they're waiting to get the ball back, right?
Yeah.
And it's not that they're aggressively trying to get up in their face in order to win the ball back. They're waiting for it to come back to them. They're waiting for England to kick it back. They're waiting for an error. They're waiting for something to happen. And then they're soaking up in defence, waiting for it to come so that they can spring into action. They're basically kind of always in transition. Like they're always waiting to start again. Their defence is set up so that they can attack afterwards rather than to defend.
Yeah.
And they do an okay job of defending a particularly unexciting England attack, which isn't really doing anything. But it doesn't ever feel like they're going to put pressure on and win any points or win any ball out of their defence.
The moment where I think the momentum really swings back in England's favour, Gregan throws an absolutely honking pass out to the wing, which bobbles along the floor. Cap boots it downfield, hacks it along the floor, and it's back in the Australian 22. England win it back. Gomesol goes for a crossfield kick, which is speculative, but not a bad kick.
Yeah.
And everybody knocks it on from both teams. All 15 players decide, let's just knock this ball on.
Yeah.
But the first one was done by Australia. So England get the put in 5 metres out.
And from that scrum, England mince them.
Yeah.
Vickery shoves them back. The penalty's given. Wilkinson knocks it over and England take the lead.
You say the penalty's given. It's Rocky Elson professional foul. He sees that they're essentially about to get marched back over the line. So he breaks off the scrum to handle the ball, knock it out of the scrum. To stop England from being able to play it. Complete, total professional foul. I totally see why he went for it. I think it's an entirely fair penalty to go away. But yeah, Wilkinson ends up knocking it over. It's worth 3 points.
We also do get in the lead up to this, beforehand, a penalty for Dan Vickerman doing a mad assault on Andy Gomesol.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And once again, he's playing the nine, not realising who the nine necessarily is.
Well, like, Andy Gomesol gives him a little shove, right? And so Vickerman picks him up and he does, like, a full-on, like, body slam swing, like, throws him at the ground. Like, bloody MMA shit. But Andy Gomesol being like, hee-hee-hee, I'm Andy Gomesol.
Both him and Peter Richards have been Vickermaned.
Yeah. Just unnecessary being a prick. You know, there's a time and a place, mate. Not straight in front of the touch judge.
Yeah. And, you know, a bit frustrating because... So far in this tournament and in the 2011 tournament, looking back, it made me realise how good a player Dan Vickerman actually was.
Yeah.
But sadly, this was not his best game.
No. Speaking of nines and not the best game, George Gregan starts to look more and more rattled as this game goes on.
I think when he throws that pass, when he throws that pass and it costs Australia all the momentum, all the attack, I think suddenly he starts to compound these errors.
Yeah. It's really weird. I've never seen this George Gregan before.
No.
That he looks like he knows this is his last game for Australia.
Yeah.
And that starts to get to him. And the pressure of knowing this is it, you know, that it isn't, funnily enough, right? At the end of this game, a full-time whistle went now with 10 minutes to go in this game. There wouldn't be anyone saying 4 more years to him because he didn't have 4 more years. This is him gone. This is his last game for Australia. He's retiring. He was one of the first players to go off to Japan, really kind of legitimize that league going over there, being one of the first like big overseas names to go over. And then, you know, from there, from going to Suntory Sun Goliath in 2008, was there for years, played until he was like 40 odd. And then, you know, that very much opened the pathway. It's Shane Williams go soon after, Stephen Donald as well. You had loads of those players starting to join, starting to go over to the Japanese league. But it started by George Gregan going after the World Cup. He knows that's coming. He knows this is it. And it kind of starts to get to him. And his options start to get more and more erratic. He's saying more on himself. And none of it's going well. He doesn't look like himself, his normal, calm, controlled prick self.
Yeah. Instead, he's just being a prick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it has a bit of a ripple effect on Australia.
Yeah.
George Smith drops quite a clean-cut chance. Berrick Barnes takes a desperate swipe at a drop goal, which isn't really on. And there's nobody there to really advise him on what play to go with or how to set it up or anything. And he just goes for it kind of like out of chance. And that one is not as good an option as the Latham one.
They give away a really stupid penalty on halfway and Wilkinson goes for the post. He misses it, but it's still like, you still kind of very much look at Australia as they are starting to rattle and fall over themselves.
Yeah. I'll read out my notes on that section, actually. Mortlock smashed by Johnny Wilkinson. It was a great hit by Wilkinson. As Mortlock was making a break, Wilkinson just smashes him. There's no, straight to the floor. And Australia have a 4v1 overlap. And Paul Sackey does a phenomenal job of shutting this down. Obviously, at the same time, you know, Latham bombed it, dropping the ball. Even before that, you could argue that Gitto passed to the wrong guy rather than going for a miss pass or whatever. But Sackey does an exceptional piece of defence, flying up, putting the pressure on, forcing the dropped ball and shutting the overlap down entirely. I've then written down, touch judge steps in to give a penalty, but wasn't listening to what it was for because Alea is playing in the background. I was listening to more important things.
The touch just steps in for Dan Vickerman, absolutely like marsupialing Andy Gomesol.
Oh, that's the one.
He like puts him in a cannon and then fires him back out.
Okay.
So yeah, so England are on top, but not very far ahead on the scoreline. And Australia have this real sense as we get to like 5 minutes out of like, shit, no, now's the time. And they start to look more serious in the last 5 minutes rather than like, this will come good, we'll be, you know, we'll be fine. Suddenly they start to play it like it's a World Cup quarterfinal rather than like a piss about game.
Also, they bring on Drew Mitchell, who has a real impact.
Makes a break immediately.
His first touch of the ball, his first passage of play, makes a break, dummies around one man. Brilliant break, gets them up, and you start to wonder, like, oh, are they going to have this momentum again? And Simon Shaw, being the chippy big bastard he is, gets through to the chippy little bastard on the other team in George Gregan. And as soon as he picks the ball up, Shaw essentially dives over the ruck and hugs his arms to kind of like clasp them and force them into dropping the ball. It's a brilliant turnover by Simon Shaw. And like just when it counted, just as Australia got quick ball and again compounds another Gregan knock on. He makes two in a row as well. Where there's one really bad one as well where Gregan knocks the ball on. England dive on it. And out of sheer just frustration and just annoyance at himself, Gregan then just goes and handles in the ruck and tries to win it back.
Yeah.
And gets penalised for it. And it's just appalling.
Yeah. However, Australia, as they start to string things together, do get two good passages of attack.
Yeah.
And one of them, as we got into 77 minutes, gets them up into the English half. They get out into the corner. And who should step up but Joe Worsley? Fresh onto the field. He's been on for about 10 minutes at this point. And he just dives over the ruck. Really simple penalty. Alan Rowland sticks his arm out, gives a penalty, and Australia are given the most difficult choice imaginable.
Yeah.
They've got Stirling Mortlock, who has a 50-metre odd boot, but the penalty is in the corner. It's like on the 5-metre.
I'd say right, about 45 metres out?
48 metres on the screen, yeah. So 48 metres on the angle, like in the corner. One of the most difficult gettable shots in rugby.
The absolute stones on Stirling Mortlock to step up and take this kick.
Yeah. What would you have done in the situation?
I think I'd have backed Mortlock.
I wouldn't have.
You wouldn't have.
I wouldn't have.
If I think I was it's so easy with hindsight to say no, but I think I would have backed Mortlock.
The problem here is Stirling Mortlock was captain, right?
That's true.
I think if someone else is captain who isn't the goal kicker, they don't do that. They don't take that shot.
That's a good point. If Gitto was the captain instead, let's say.
Yeah.
As somebody else who's been in that scenario. Or George Smith.
Captain. Yeah. Stephen Moore, who captains them later.
I think I would have gone up to Mortlock and said, like, do you think you're going to get this?
Yes.
Whereas instead he's having that conversation with himself, which you're right, does slightly change it.
That's such a difficult conversation to have as well, because you've got to weigh up the fact that you might miss it. Right. Yeah. Whereas if you're the goal kicker, purely the goal kicker, all you're thinking about is, I'm going to get this. This is in my range, right? If you're the captain, you're thinking about, well, if I don't get this and it was a mistake.
I look like a twat.
Exactly. It's such a difficult
decision. He's got the pressure of the teammates.
But not Australia. Yeah, but Stirling Mortlock, he's taking responsibility for the full team on himself here in two different ways.
And bloody hell, it's a great kick he puts in.
Yeah.
By the way.
I would have gone for the corner and tried to set up a drop goal with Dill immediately.
Yeah.
We saw as we recorded this yesterday, but you know, in the last couple of days, the Ospreys Ulster, right? Where they ran the simplest drop goal drill imaginable, the Ospreys, where they just chucked it to the centre in the middle, the 12, and then immediately back to the 10 who kicked the drop goal.
Yeah.
Literally run that. Run the simplest drop goal drill anyone's ever seen off, you know, ball at the front. But like, I would have gone to the corner for the express decision of wanting a drop goal drill.
The thing then is, you've got to win the line out then.
Sure, you know? Sure.
And but, yeah, literally, Simon Shaw, there's a possibility that he steals the line out and everyone's going, why did they not take the three? There's no right or wrong answer, is the long and short of it.
I would back securing a line out on the 22 over nailing a shot at goal from 48 metres in the corner.
Which is valid. But yeah, there's not necessarily a right and wrong here. I guess there is a wrong because the kick didn't go through the posts.
Yeah.
But it gives it a bloody good go. He sends it miles. It's so close for what a difficult kick it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, he originally hits it to the right and it curls round and goes off to the left.
He clearly hits it with a curve. And the curve's too much round because he's trying to accommodate for the wind. The fact this is an open-air stadium, so the wind really gets to him. Didn't have the roof that it has nowadays. And then, he's putting everything into it because it is the most difficult, the longest range kick imaginable.
So
it would have just been really satisfying to be Australia and beat England for a last-minute drop goal.
Yes, it really would have. It really would. Oh, that would have been so poetic if so. However, there's a short back and forth, as you say. We've got maybe 2 minutes left here. There's a turnover. That Australia get.
Yeah.
What, a minute and a half maybe left to go?
Yeah. Yeah, thereabouts. It's on 78 minutes. And Gregan hits in field. And as Barnes is setting up the attack, he notices on the short side, the forwards have just gone and positioned themselves into like the sort of shit the All Blacks were running last year, where they were positioning like a free pod on the width so that they could like, you know, split and do hands down there.
Yeah.
And Adam Fryer takes it on the short side. He draws his man. Pops it to Al Baxter with nobody covering him on the touchline. Baxter gets on the outside, makes about 10 metres and sees Jason Robinson and I think Wilkinson's covering as well in front of him.
Yeah.
And in Al Baxter, right? Al Baxter,
the tight end prop who's on the bench.
Prop, yeah, the 31-year-old Australian replacement prop. Looks at Jason Robinson, looks at his options, and goes, well, I could just take contact and try and set up position. Or I can try and take Jason Robinson on the outside when I've got 1 meter to less than 1 meter. I've got like 2 inches to work in.
There are 30 seconds left of this World Cup quarterfinal. Yeah. And you know what?
It's
in true spirit of VipBoy, I fancy a crack there.
79:21 on the clock. And he goes, I'm literally on the touchline. I'm going to try and take Jason Robinson on the non-existent outside. And so he steps into touch. And Robinson just has to like give him the smallest shove and he's over the line and out.
And Robinson's kind of like, oh, I didn't think he'd do that.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't see that one coming. Yeah,
Instead of cutting it in. And yeah, he just asked to get put into touch there by Robinson.
It's so stupid. And suddenly Australia have gone from having a good attack where they're completely on top. They've got all the momentum. They're going forward and they're getting up to probably around the 22. Instead, England have got a line out. and 15 seconds to run down. And they took it straight to Corey, who catches it cleanly, brings it down, and in the process, somehow loses the ball.
Yeah, and you think, oh God, Australia, this is your third time that you've threatened to win this game in the last couple of minutes. And here you are. They send it in field. Matt Gitto makes a great carry on first phase just to get them moving forwards. Hugh McMenamin comes around the corner, puts in another brutal carry, and you go, they are on song here. They're set up to do something. Yeah. I don't know what. But at the same time, in this kind of 5 second period, you think, does Berrick Barnes, Mortlock, or Latham have it in them to knock over a drop goal?
And yet, and then, who else but George Gregan finds himself kind of at the heart of a confusion in the middle of the field?
Yeah. So Gregan ends up kind of rucking over, and Matt Dunning comes in at scrum half.
Yeah.
And flaps at the ball with his hand and sends it forward.
And sure enough, as day follows night, Alan Rowland blows up. And then he says full time, these remains of him exploded. No, so Rowland blows for full time and England lose it in celebration.
Mate, I love this. I was so happy for England at the final whistle here because they are so clearly out in their feet. Gomersall's in tears at the final whistle.
Yeah.
And you know what? Fair play to him. He's put in a brilliant shift. And rightfully, they are absolutely delighted. Like, yeah. They're all jumping up and down, like hugging each other. It's just, I think they clearly believe that they could do this, but I don't necessarily think that they knew that they would.
Yeah.
And you could see that they realise this is an overachievement here in a good way. Yeah.
He said, as he said, at least dwell on it in the moment for a bit. Otherwise, what the hell is the point?
Yeah, damn right. And yeah, it's great. The English celebrations are fantastic. The fans are absolutely loving it. And yeah, the players out on the pitch are sparing no emotion. And it, I don't know, man, it's just, it makes games like this so much more worth watching. Because, as you say, if you're going to win one of the biggest games of your life and not absolutely love it and lap it up, then there's no point in sport because it's a fundamentally emotional thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. That was exactly what Phil Vickery said in the full-time whistle, that sport throws up funny things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's the funny thing about sport. And sometimes you can have a team that isn't rated at all, can do that.
I was delighted for England, genuinely. The fact that they, you know, after being written off, and genuinely written off this time as being like such a poor team, they delivered such a brilliant performance that was just extremely, I want to say clinical. I think in terms of point scoring, it wasn't. But in terms of how they played, in terms of executing a very specific game plan, it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
They absolutely left nothing out there. And afterwards, you can see George Gregan in the huddle talking to the Australians and saying, four more years, boys, for you and not for me. So, because I'm fucking off to Japan.
On the balance of the five games they've played, I think Australia would deserve to win the World Cup. I don't think there's a way in hell you can say Australia would deserve to win that game.
Yeah, exactly that. England, by far the better team.
Yeah.
They looked just so much more composed in the big moments of the game that all landed on England's side. Other than the Tinkuri try, that is the only big moment that fell in Australia's favour.
Yeah, I think if this had been Ireland or Scotland or Italy or France or a lot of other teams that put it all together for one big game in the quarterfinal after being dog shit, everyone would celebrate and remember this game.
Yeah.
But instead, because it's England, people like to dogpile on them.
Yeah.
And I think it's something rugby needs to kind of outgrow a bit is this unnecessary hate of England, because it's fine in football because you've got lots of villains in football.
Yeah.
And England are one of a big, you know, slew of villains. You've got, you know, Germany, you've got bloody, some can argue the Brazils and Spains and teams that, you know, had periods of dominating it. And in England, just another one where people, and it's funnier and it's a different thing.
Yeah.
It kind of, when, and again, like we just had this World Rugby report on, you know, abuse in the Rugby World Cup and how most of it is directed towards England because England are pantomime villain. And actually, you've got to look at the effect that has on coaches, players, and also fans. You know, mental health, people are getting abused and shouted out for being English fans. And also,
if
I think
it's friendly banter, then sure. But
that's one thing, yeah. Yeah. And I think part of that line is knowing when to give them credit.
Yeah.
And I don't think England teams get credit for great wins unless they're completely dominant.
Yeah.
You know? And this was a fantastic win. It wasn't the All Blacks game in 2019. It wasn't one of the games where they've gone and beaten Scotland by 60 points or whatever. I think they deserve enormous credit for this. And yet, in the kind of popular rugby consciousness, this England team is only remembered for being lucky.
Yeah.
And actually, they were brilliant for this game at least.
I was talking about this the other day, that I think people were so critical of England in the 2023 World Cup, saying they were playing shit. And in the couple of games since then, that they have won, right? And I'm so reluctant to criticise them, because people were doing that to Wales in 2019.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
The surrounding areas of that, people were saying, like, oh, no, they're shit. The, you know, just getting lucky, having lucky refereeing decisions and stuff. And it's like, well, no, they know how to win games. And the current England team clearly do. And it doesn't matter if it looks pretty in the 80 minutes. And it's the same thing with this game here, this 2007 quarterfinal. I think this is the sort of performance that completely galvanizes a squad. It suddenly genuinely does not matter how shit you've been in the previous four games, because you've won the big one that matters and you've played brilliantly. And at that point, you do want to work for each other. Yeah. You are much tighter as a group, and you are much more, you're tenfold more likely to win the World Cup off a performance like that. In fact, even maybe more so if you played shit in the group stages.
Yeah.
You've shown that you have the level of resilience to come through the other side of that. It's an absolutely brilliant England performance. I'm delighted for them.
What happened for England against Argentina in 2023?
Yeah.
You know, like, against Argentina, they suddenly put it all together. And they weren't great, but they found a way to dominate that game.
Yeah.
Through kind of alternate tactics.
Yeah.
And it was phenomenal. It was amazing. And it kind of took them apart. And it really galvanised that team. And I don't think it would have hit the highs they did in terms of getting third in the world and almost beating South Africa and almost making the final, getting so close. I don't think that would have happened if they hadn't been so shit in the warm-ups.
Yeah.
I think they kind of had to ride through that and come through the other side. And again, I've always felt this, of all the great teams in rugby went through adversity, or were the All Blacks, who have had that kind of winning culture for literally hundreds of years. And they're building on building on building on that. And I think it was a big part of why I felt like Ireland weren't going to win the World Cup. I felt like they didn't have that kind of adversity. They kind of just built slowly. And then, you know, they lost one game where they were battered by New Zealand. And they kind of went, oh, that was annoying. And I think now, after last year's World Cup, they've kind of had the hurt and pain that they needed in order to rebuild from there.
Same
and
with
now
France.
I think, yeah. I think France, though, had had 10 years of being shit, which could have driven them on.
Which but is
I also,
true.
I also don't argue with
like that these specific players have now had that.
Exactly, exactly.
They made it as far as a pretty mid French team that had Sebastian Valmahina punch them out of the World Cup. Like they got just as far as that with one of the best teams they've ever had.
People talk about Saracens, right, as a completely dominant force in English rugby. The start of this kind of dynasty, they lost two Premiership finals in a row.
Yeah.
You know, one in the last minute, they kicked the penalty they thought was going to win in the 79th minute, and Dan Hipkiss, on the bench and not getting on here, scores the winning try in overtime. You know, they then lost the following year. And like, that sort of thing builds a squad and builds a squad up. You know,
Definitely. Being
mid-table, struggling for a while, or a really heartbreaking quarter or semi-final turned you into something. The 99 World Cup builds the 2003 World Cup for England.
Yeah.
You know, the 2007 World Cup builds the 2011-2015 World Cups for the All Blacks.
Yeah.
It's always the way. The bloody losing by 50 to the All Blacks builds that Springboks team into the team we've now got here.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. I think this England team really, really rode that well without actually having to lose many games.
I was expecting I'd come in
microcosm.
I was expecting I'd come in and say, like, oh, England are really lucky here. But actually, you know what, they really deserve that. I've not got a bad word to say about the way they played in this game. So
they're the better team. They're the better team. And again, like, reading their reflections on this years down the line, Paul Sackey saying it's the best game we've played in this quarterfinal. He loved it. You know, he did mentally, I think Australia were gone and they just kind of got into them. And yeah, like, Joe Worsley, so up for it. Wilkinson's talked about really enjoying this game. Worsley just say him giving away the penalty, says, I would have thought about that for years and years, probably forever, if they hadn't missed it.
Yeah, fair.
But the really fun stuff, when they talk about this later, right, when they talked about this in 2023, was Joe Worsley discussed the night out they had afterwards.
Oh, yes, hit me.
So this game was in the day. Then that evening was the France-New Zealand game, obviously played in Cardiff, despite the World Cup being in France. And Worsley said, the evening was incredible. We were in Marseille Harbour on somebody's boat. There were 500,000 French fans watching the quarterfinal against New Zealand. It was just a wonderful weekend of rugby. One of those memorable days.
Oh, that's great.
So they watched it on, they watched that quarterfinal then on a boat surrounded by French fans, all of them drinking heavily.
That would have been surreal.
Yep. He says, then at the end of the night, we got a lift home from the police to our hotels. There were no taxis running because it's bloody Marseille and they'll probably, you know, all crimed to death.
I was going to say, there's surely very heavily staffed on police in Marseille.
This is what they're doing. They're not reporting any of the crimes or solving the actual crimes. They're off bloody giving rugby teams escorts. He said, there were
all
no
cabs are bastards. A cab.
There were no taxis, but the police had one of those wagons they use for when there's a riot, and they drove us home in it.
My God.
So they went home in a riot van. Simon Shaw then said, I think that's one of the ones that stands out from the World Cup. Each time we got one step closer, we really enjoyed it. He said, I didn't get a lift back to the hotel in the police wagon, though. I acquired an abandoned moped.
No.
Which they kept for the duration of the World Cup.
No way.
So Simon Shaw stole a moped and just kept it for the rest of the World Cup and just rode it around Marseille for a while.
You wouldn't argue.
No.
What a hero. Good old Simon
Shaw. What a hero. So, should we do Man of the Match, Dick of the Day?
Let's do it.
Should we start with Man of the Match?
Yeah, let's. I've got a few written down. I think Andrew Sheridan was fantastic. I think
we've not really spoken too much
about him. Was he? Okay.
Yeah.
Not surprised there. I think he was excellent. Great carrying, great scrummaging. Johnny Wilkinson, we can't avoid. I think he was brilliant. He was the heartbeat of this England team. And frankly, they might not win this game without him. You know, well, certainly if they've got Johnny, they've got Ollie Barkley playing, they don't win this. But, you know, Johnny Wilkinson is essential to them winning this game. But there's two names that are the main front runners for me. One of them is Mike Catt. I think this is a great game by him. His kicking game was fantastic. Defensively, really solid. Carried the ball well. But man of the match for me has to go to Phil Vickery. The platform he left at scrum time and around the park with his leadership was second to none. He was exactly the player England needed. All the big moments surround him and the scrum until obviously he goes off when he's given everything he has. He's absolutely spent by the end. So yeah, man of the match for me is Phil Vickery. Got to give the front row some love.
I like that. I really like that. And I think that's very deserved. For me, I think it's a two-horse race. I think there's a few players you mentioned as well who are very good. For me, man of the match is purely between Johnny Wilkinson and Simon Shaw.
Oh, Shawsy's a great shout as well.
I thought Johnny Wilkinson, absolutely brilliant. Is a large part of the reason why England won this game.
Yeah, agreed.
And I kind of had him pinned in for most of it, I think. But the sheer donkey work of Simon Shaw, the sheer work rate and effort, and he plays 80 minutes, you know, which isn't always common for a lock. Goes the full 80, gives absolutely everything he's got, and is everywhere, just everywhere. And in a game where England's strategy is to pick fights at rucks and do a lot of lineouts, Simon Shaw is in his element.
Yeah.
And so I think for that reason, I am narrowly giving Simon Shaw my man of the match.
Even Wilkinson was brilliant and so was Cap, but you can't give a man of the match to a back in a game like this, can you?
Exactly, exactly. If it is, it's the 10, and only if he gets 100% on his kicking, and Wilkinson missed two.
Fair call, fair call. Dick of the day, then, for me, it can only be Stephen Moore for that kick, for picking it up, kicking it sideways, and almost costing his team a try in the first 5-10 minutes of the biggest game of his life so far. It's got to be Stephen Moore for that kick.
You say it can only be Stephen Moore, right?
Yeah.
I think there's three contenders. One, very much Stephen Moore. Another, Alan Rowland, right? Did you watch the coin toss?
Yes, I think I did, but go on.
So instead of doing the coin toss himself, Alan Rowland
just gets this little kid.
Yeah, he just got like child labour, like child slave labour.
Oh my God, I know what you're about to give this for. Yes, carry on.
Well, so Alan Rowland just gives like child slave labour. Like, and I think if you're a slave runner, then you are a Dick of the Day contender.
Also, when he does that, the kid flips the coin and catches it. And Alan Rowland is like patronising him, saying, yeah, and then you put it on your hand. And the kid knows that. The kid does that.
The kid is doing it.
Kids are normally stupid, but that kid was fine. And kids Alan Rowland misjudged him.
Kids are less stupid than Alan Rowland.
Yeah, exactly.
But my dick of the day, right, and I can't believe this isn't who you went for, is Al Baxter.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I'm running into touch.
Taking Jason Robinson on the outside.
I'm thinking, I fancy this. I fancy beating one of the nippiest men to ever play rugby union and rugby league. I'm going, tell you what, I think I can take him on the outside. I'm only twice his weight.
Fair call. You know what? You are right. It is him. It's not Stephen Moore. But also, I've made my decision now, so.
Well, I think that brings us to a glorious end.
It does.
Thank you for joining me. 4 more years, boys. But only, actually, 1 more week. Next week, right? It's the big one. It's the great one. The 42nd game of the World Cup. The game it's remembered for. One of the most famous games of all time. France 20, New Zealand 18.
I am so excited for this. So before we do that, have you watched this game before in its entirety?
I have.
I have as well, but I don't remember all of it that well, and I'm very
excited. I'm really excited. This is one of the greats. This is one of the games. When we start this podcast, right, if this had been to well-adjusted people, they would have only done games like this next one.
Yes.
Where they watch that game back. We've done, like, Australia 37, Canada 6, you know.
Is there another game in this Rugby World Cup in 2007 that we've already covered that would be on that list? Because, like, in 87, it's just that semi-final between France and Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, all the finals kind of come up as, you know, instantly iconic moments. The opening game, Argentina beating France.
Oh, I guess so, yeah.
And you can make an argument for the 36-0 game.
And South Africa, Tonga as well, actually. But yeah.
Yeah, there's a few of them dotted around where there's like, they are great
but this
games.
Is but like, they, this is the
would
the,
South
the
Africa Tonga
time.
Be there though? Like, it wasn't coming out when the BBC were doing all the all great matches stuff.
That's
it was entirely
fault.
Games like this. It truly is. Yeah, Brian Habana.
But yeah, point is, you're right. This is in the top percentile of most talked about Rugby World Cup games of all time.
Most
it
rugby
might be
matches.
The, yeah, it might be the most talked about rugby game of all time.
Yes. Man of the Match is going to be very interesting when we get there.
I can't wait to pick that.
So, thank you for joining us. I hope you've enjoyed that. Please join us again next week for France, New Zealand, the big one, dropping into your feeds of podcasts. We're doing these early in the week now instead of Fridays. It's sort of just become what we're doing. We may go back to Fridays. I'm not sure. I think we're looking at Tuesdays at the minute.
Yeah, Six Nations on in it. So.
Yeah, Six Nations. Everything's kind of funny, squiggly. I hope you're not squiggly. I hope you're lovely
Squidgy.
And wonderful. Yes, rugby retrospective.
Should I be called Squiggle Rugby?
No. Thank you, not Squiggle.
Rugby League Squid.
Thank you, Rugby League Squid. Thank you to Rugby Union Squid Me. Thank you for listening. And we will see you next week for the proper rugby.
Sonny Bill!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.